Good morning. Can a two-year process to create a plan to save Mauna Loa Bay do just that? The Imua Mauna Loa project says it will involve all stakeholders. We'll hear from Malama Mauna Loa's executive director, Fraser McGilvray. And the Ethics Commission has been asking Representative Matt Lopresti about the Cool Schools Forever campaign. He says it's inappropriate, and we'll consider why later this hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Slam poetry is only part of the multimedia extravaganza Ke Aloha has put together. The story of everything is an epic poem with visual art, movement, music, and more. And printmaker Denise is a believer in the power of art to heal the deepest wound. We'll look ahead to her exhibit, Nurturing Absence.
It's Monday, September 21st. The conversation starts right after a look at today's headlines. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation for a Monday. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Kind of looking at the forming a coalition of people with very different agendas, yeah?
Different agendas, and you're talking about Mauna Loa Bay.
Yeah.
And we last time visited this when there wasn't such a coalition talking about being built, but we're going to talk about that this morning. Now, you know that one of the most environmentally challenged sites of the state runs from Black Point to about Portlock, and that's where the agreement ends among a lot of environmentalists and many in East Honolulu. Finding a way to restore Mauna Loa Bay has prompted anger between some who use the bay commercially or recreationally and some conservation groups, plus the state and federal agencies charged with stopping the degradation. Last week, the group Malama Mauna Loa announced a two-year project to bring stakeholders together to formulate a plan. Fraser McGilvray is the executive director of Malama Mauna Loa, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Morning, Beth Ann.
Last time we talked was back in July, when there was a lot of consternation, a lot of anger, and that meeting that was held in Hawaii Kai, where people were just intractable. How did you get them from that point to let's get everybody together to at least look at this with buy-in from all these different organizations?
What we're really looking to do is get a ground-up approach in the Mauna Loa Bay community. And so last week, Malama Mauna Loa, in conjunction with a consortium of partners and partner agencies and partner organizations, launched a project called Imua Mauna Loa. What we're really looking to do is discuss with the community what it is the community actually wants, bring representatives of approximately 30 different community sectors, for want of a better description, together and start and ask them, you know, what is your vision for the Bay? How do we get it to be a better place? And, you know, how do we move towards that jointly in a way that benefits the Bay ecologically and benefits everything, everyone in that region economically as well? It has to do both.
That seemed to be what a lot of people were complaining about back in the summer, that there really hadn't been enough opportunities and that it was looking at the NOAA proposal to expand the marine sanctuary, but without a lot of input or discussions of anything else. It was sort of like, we're looking at this only. Moving off of that, were people more willing to settle down and say, okay, we may have different visions, but at least we're willing to work on it? From what you say, that seems to be what the real sticking point was.
That certainly was one of the major sticking points. I think what we saw in the summer, we saw a proposal from a federal agency that was a very top-down approach, and it was statewide. It wasn't just in Mauna Loa Bay. And it was very much that top-down, here's what we plan to do, tell us what you think. What we're looking to do is very much bring the community together, find out what they actually want in the first place. Start with a blank piece of paper and then develop a plan for Mauna Loa Bay that will have as much community buy-in as we can possibly get. And then take that to the regulating agencies and saying, this is what the community actually does want. please enact that to make the Bay a better place for everyone.
And on the flip side of this, with the state and federal agencies, are they willing to allow the communities to come up with a plan themselves?
We've been working with the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries and with DLNR, and we have the support of both agencies in this process. So we are going to be working with DLNR and with the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries, because Mauna Loa Bay right now is already part of the existing humpback whale sanctuary. So the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries does have a role to play currently.
They've been involved since 1997?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's been a long time they've been involved. So they have a supporting role to play, as well as DLNR, to just make sure that, you know, that they're involved from the very beginning so that nothing's a surprise to them.
With the various different groups who use the bay for different purposes, as well as the conservation groups who are saying, look, the degradation is going to continue until we have a plan to start to truly arrest it. Is the sensitivity there now that maybe people need to be a little bit more careful even as this plan is being developed and be more concerned about what they're doing or how they're doing? Or is that not on their radar until you get a plan?
I'm not really sure if that's on. I think it's certainly on some people's radar. I mean, some people know that there is a decline in the bay, and many people recognize that. Many people know that they want the bay to be a better place, and they're willing to come together to try and figure out how we make that happen. There are some people out there who clearly are, you know, have best business practice in mind, you know, and minimizing ecological impact, etc. And that's what we hope from everybody, obviously. And you know, if we can bring everyone together in the one place to discuss how we get the bay to be a better place and in a more healthy state, then that's a good thing for everyone, as far as many people are concerned.
What's the plan to bring them together? When's the first meeting?
Well, right now what we're looking for with the Mua Mauna Loa is we have a number of community sectors identified, but we don't actually have necessarily those positions filled. And we're looking for the community to come forward, members of the community to say, we'd like to get involved in this. We believe this is the bay needs to be healed, and we need to, you know, all come together to do that. So anyone who does want to get involved, the best is just get in touch with us. You know, muamonalua.org is our website, and people can find all the information there if they want to get involved and can, you know, feel like they represent that community sector well. Please come and join us. We welcome everyone. This is a 100% transparent process that we hope that the community will really get behind.
It seems a little surprising that you say that you haven't had people sort of come out and say, yes, I'll be this part and I'll be that part and I'll join in the effort, given the rancor that people were expressing in July. Very often people will say very negative things, but they don't necessarily want to work on some of the more positive aspects. Is there a real, you know, sort of, you know, crucial number of people you need to have involved with this from all of those sectors to be able to make this project go forward?
I think the project will go forward, and we really want as many people from all sectors, commercial, from people who use the bay recreationally, from people who use the bay commercially, and from people who live on it, walk on it, just drive past it and look at it and, you know, think, oh, that looks nice, but it could be, you know, I hear that there aren't as many fish in there as there could be. We need them to, you know, we need everyone involved as much as possible.
And on the scientific side, to be make sure that whatever it is that you create is going to be based on evidence-based science.
Fundamentally, this has to be based in science.
Yeah. And so what happens on that end as everyone is talking about their feelings toward the bay and what they'd like to see happen with the bay?
We have a number of academics and you know, practical science. We need to base this in social science, biological science, and traditional knowledge. Those three things really underpin the knowledge. And we have a bunch of academics who have offered their help and their assistance to actually come and lay the groundwork and say, here's what we know now. Come up with your vision. How do we get from where we are now to what you want it to be to make sure that the bay is in a healthier state and to make sure that everyone can still enjoy the bay in many of the same ways that they currently do?
Well, we hope you get a group together soon. We'll be watching.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here. Fraser McGilvray is the executive director of Malama Mauna Loa. We'll be right back.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13, and coming up, looking ahead to the premiere of an epic poem that sets out to tell the story of everything. But first, your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaiti.
In today's backyard quiz, we got to thinking about a small town to the north of us. It's about 32 miles from where we are now in our Honolulu studio. It's a town like so many around the islands with a plantation heritage. Much of its population was formed in the sugar rush of the early 20th century that brought an influx of laborers from China, Portugal, Japan, Korea, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines. When labor and production costs grew in the 1980s and 90s, the sugar industry went overseas, but the population of this town remained. It still has plenty of its plantation-era charm, with the now dormant sugar mill as a local landmark that plays host to more than 30 businesses. We're looking for the name of this Oahu community of some 4,000 souls, and we'll be back with it in half an hour. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Ke Aloha, Hawaii's poet laureate, is committed to the idea of the poet as messenger, and that means taking on ever more challenging subject matter. And it doesn't get much more challenging than setting out to tell the story of everything. He's drawing on every resource at his command to get it done. The premiere is coming up this weekend, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Ke Aloha.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
Sure. Set lofty goals for yourself, huh?
Well, you know, I mean, it wasn't really a goal. It was just this thing that I had to do.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it, like the art called to me, and I wanted to do science justice. I wanted to do indigenous cultures justice. I wanted to do storytelling justice. So I just got thrown into it.
Yeah, I was sort of curious if it started as a small idea and grew, or if it was always an all-encompassing kind of an idea.
Well, you know, ever since I branched off and got into poetry and storytelling, mm-hmm. I'd always wondered, I've always tried every so often to write scientifically, but it always came out poorly. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, I found out that I was going to have a baby. And then all kinds of ideas came flooding into my brain as I started to ponder what it would be like to raise a child. And one of the questions that kept coming up is, one day this kid's going to ask me where we come from. Mm-hmm. And me, I don't have a religion that I subscribe to. I subscribe to science as sort of the backbone for
what we know.
Yeah, for what we know and how I could communicate. So I started to think about, well, how could I communicate everything that we know about where we come from? Mm-hmm. And that's when it finally hit me that, oh, what if I turned that knowledge base into a story, into something that had love and hate and conflict and resolution and climax and all those things, those narrative things that, mm-hmm. that make something interesting.
The strategies of art applied to science.
Exactly, and so that's when I started to realize, oh, that's the golden ticket. That's the thing. That's the angle that mm-hmm. I can take where I can kind of wrap everything that I've learned in my life, and present it in a way that could be digestible.
Well, as somebody who understands science, you understand the poetry of science, right? The wonderful way that when you really understand the science of something, there's a beauty to the way things come together.
Yeah.
That's miraculous, right?
Absolutely. It's so beautiful. And it's taken me this long to finally realize sort of all those intricate ways of being able to communicate that as well.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, just the story of science in itself, what science has told us, is really interesting. But now I'm trying to amplify that and take it to the next level and make it into something that the general public can get down with.
I'm seeing a lack of trust in science in society lately. a lack of reverence for it that, mm-hmm. that seems to have gone away. Is that an accurate perception, do you think?
Yeah, it could either be that, and maybe, and we can start to analyze like where that comes from. You know, does it come from a non-understanding of science? Does it come from a fear of science? What does it come from?
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I'm trying to address here is by making science more accessible, I'm hoping to bring people in so that they're not so distrusting or fearful of what science is telling us.
Because when you reveal it, when you reveal the truth of science, it's inevitably beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. Totally.
there's no revelation you can make about the universe that is not beautiful, right?
Yeah. And well, the interesting thing, though, to now that I'm thinking about, like, you know, this distrust, whatever, this lack of science love, science can also tell us some things that are very difficult to accept. You know, it challenges us at the very core, whether it comes to our sense of morality, or that comes to our sense of economics, depending on where you come from or what you're into. I mean, science does tell us some uncomfortable things, such as global climate change and, those other.
Well, how about man's inhumanity to man? You know, can science explain that? You know, what is wrong with this organism that we just keep messing everything up?
I don't know. I don't have the answers for that.
Well, that's too bad. I was kind of hoping you would. Would solve a lot of problems if you did.
At least not at 8:15 in the morning, Monday morning.
Understandable. But at the same time, you know, this has to be a quest, right? This cannot be a completed, you can't say I found it at the end of the show, right?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, like the whole thing is a process. And, you know, I've got 6 scenes in this production, mm-hmm. and each scene, has its own lessons that I draw from it. So, we go from the Big Bang and everything that happened with that, and then we go into the stars and everything that had to happen in the stars, mm-hmm. and then we go into our solar system, so sort of a planetary guide and, you know, what was going on with our planets and the moon and the sun, and then we get into the evolution of life from single-celled organism, mm-hmm. all the way up into human, and then once we become human, we analyze the migration from humans from Africa throughout the rest of the world, and then we go into the future after that and talk about us today and what we need to do in order to move forward. So we're really just—I'm really summarizing 13.7 billion years worth of time in an hour and a half stage show.
It sounds as if the structure is kind of a long zoom in, you know, like a Google Earth search. You get closer and closer and closer, right?
Yeah, totally, exactly. And you know, I mean, the first scene takes place within the course of basically 200 seconds.
Uh huh.
You know. And then, so you, that's a really zoomed in perspective. And then the second scene takes the course of like maybe a few billion years. And the third scene is a few billion years. And then, you know, I mean, it's like, but then by the time we get to the, you know, when humans are created, that's only a narrative of about 200,000 years.
A blink of the eye.
So we're like, we're zooming in, we're zooming out, we're we're doing all this, you know, zoom action. Yeah. And hopefully we can learn some lessons by sort of, you know, having that focus.
Well, you there've got to be some lessons to emerge from this. Just even the act of exploring it is going to yield forth some lessons, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Has it for you?
Oh yeah, this has been quite the journey, quite the marathon. I have, you know, been just dedicating so much of my thought process and my life, and just being full time on this particular artwork and this particular production, that it has definitely had, you know, caused me to investigate how I approach my life.
So after this, would it be reassuring to just sort of paint miniatures for a while? And you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows what happens after this, right?
Like really a small canvas, greeting cards.
I'll write some haiku. I don't know.
That's perfect, yeah. Something that puts a very tight restriction on it. It would be it'd be liberating in a sense, almost.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Ke Aloha, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for coming in.
Great, thanks for having me.
Ke Aloha, Hawaii's first poet laureate, will present the world premiere of his epic poem, The Story of Everything, at Honolulu's Mamiya Theater, 7 p.m. this Saturday. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
taking a turn in public life.
We have to get government right, whether you're for big government or small government or whatever that means, because when government gets it wrong, then people suffer.
First-timers in electoral politics tell their stories. The Rookies, a series on democracy's first lap in the long race of public service. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Early gifts for the station's fall pledge drive support the purchase and creation of the programming you listen to every day. It also provides the broadcast infrastructure that delivers it to you. Mahalo to Thomas Smith of Pepe Akeo, Kenneth Aronowitz of Honolulu, and Sarah Lassiter of Holoaloa. Thank you all for your early gifts. You could make today a good time for your personal gift of support and become a first-time giver at the $10 a month sustaining member level. You can call us at 955-8821 during business hours or donate online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, protecting and managing Oahu's drinking water resources. Learn 7 ways to save water at boardofwatersupply.com.
From the outside, it looks like there's a power struggle at OHA that has the quasi-state agency at a crossroads. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair looked at the competition of voices and internal battles, and he has it for us in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth, and happy Monday.
And a good Monday to you, too. There are so many areas in which you could sort of say there's a battle here and there's a battle there. I mean, anything from Mauna Kea, ceded lands, nation building, all of that. But why does it seem to be building to such a head now with all those issues and many which we've been talking about for a long time?
Well, certainly the TMT has really elevated discussion of OHA's role to a new level, and that continues the protest over the telescopes. There are other issues as well. I mean, controversy, contention, infighting at OHA is nothing new. It's been around for a long time. The latest development has to do with something that most folks on the outside wouldn't pay attention to, has to do with the committees that OHA has, in particular the one that handles the land and the property. And basically, two trustees are complaining that there was a change made in committees. They lost their leadership. They feel that that's being done to consolidate the power of the other trustees, the majority, if you will. Now, that's sort of inside baseball for a lot of folks, but it is pretty important when you think about the landownings that OHA is trying to develop, Kaka'ako Makai. It has other properties as well. It feels it needs another revenue stream besides ceded land money to help its many beneficiaries.
You're talking about the collapse of the Land and Property Committee,
right,
with the Asset and Resource Management into this new one that's just titled Resource Management, which, you know, might look like, well, wait a minute, what are we protecting and what are we using to, dare we say, exploit to be able to make sure that there's a revenue stream?
Right, and I can tell you what the chair's position, Robert Lindsay Jr., is, that this is done to be more efficient, to streamline things, to really make the best of the management of OHA's resources. But as I said, infighting is nothing new, and we'll see where this battle goes. What's kind of hanging over everything is Nai Apuni. I'm sure a lot of folks have seen the full-page ads that are running in the newspapers and elsewhere. They're online, and it's about an election process for a Native Hawaiian a governing entity. That is underway. The selection of delegates will be starting soon in November. And the question is, if they do come forward and create an entity that they can agree on, one that would have a government-to-government relations with the United States, OHA, in theory, would be absorbed into that entity. Its assets would be transferred to this new body.
And would it really want to see itself go away?
Well, that's a very good question, but there would really probably be no purpose for OHA to continue if there's a governing entity that a majority of Hawaiians that are registered agree on. Now, you and I know that the issue of Hawaiian independence and sovereignty and self-governance is very controversial. Views all over the place, including a very persistent view that Hawaii is still a kingdom, that it was illegally overthrown. As you know, the Department of Interior has also moved forward to say we will recognize, or we are looking at recognizing, a a federally recognized entity in Hawaii for Native Hawaiians. So this is big stuff that's happening right now. That convention for Native Hawaiians to decide on government is next spring. And by the way, they could decide not to do that at all. They could go with another model. We just don't know. This is historic times.
Indeed they are. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, a lot of people have this exercise pattern where they wait too long, work out too much, pull a muscle, and then stop, right?
Have you found my pattern there, Chris?
I thought it was mine.
Well, we can argue about that. But, you know, it's very common. They call it the weekend warrior.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have time all week, so you go out on the weekend and say, I'm going to do extra working out because I didn't all week, and then you hurt yourself.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about how sometimes you can use exercise, even just a little bit during the week, to really help protect your muscles so that when you do a little extra on the weekends, you're not hurting yourself, you're actually helping yourself.
Well, most people don't stretch nearly enough, right?
Oh, I know it. And as we get older, we really do lose flexibility, and it's one of the things we need to work on the most. That and losing muscle mass. You would be amazed how much muscle mass people lose per year after the age of 50. You know, it's pretty shocking for both men and women, up to 10% every year. And you kind of have to fight against that just to stay where you're at.
Yeah, you sure do. Can you continue to build muscle mass? I hope the answer is yes.
You really can, but you have to know what exercises really are going to give you the maximum benefit, and then you have to know how to do them safely. Because how many of us have gotten injured when we think we're doing it the right way, and somebody says, you're actually hurting yourself. I've done that.
And then then it's one step forward, two steps back, right?
Exactly. So we're going to talk about how to incorporate all of those thoughts, you know, how you can do a little bit during the week, how you can do extra activity on the weekend, and how you can really use your workouts to make you stronger and work better for your whole body.
That sounds like the kind of thing a lot of people could benefit from, Kathy.
Me too.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
How could an effort be improper to solicit funds, fans, and AC units to cool kids in sweltering classrooms? That seems to be the question State Representative Matt Lopresti is asking. The Ethics Commission asked questions of him and his staff about the Cool Schools Forever campaign. Why that happened was reported to be related to concerns from the state attorney general's office, though nothing specific was detailed. And that's why Representative Lopresti says there shouldn't be questions unless there's an inquiry. He's here with us this morning in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Now, what about this business that this had something to do with the attorney general's office? What did they tell you directly, if anything?
Well, I listened to the Ethics Commission meeting, and several times Director Kondo actually mentioned the Attorney General himself had asked to look into this, and I immediately called Doug Chin, the Attorney General, and he kind of chuckled, and he said he didn't know anything about this. So it was really disappointing to hear the Commission talk about that in that way.
And what issue specifically, if anything, was asked of you when the Ethics Commission was asking you questions about the campaign?
Well, first, a little background on the program. As everybody, I think, knows in Hawaii now, it's super hot in the schools, especially in Ewa Beach. I received numerous calls and emails from parents and teachers concerned about the overwhelming heat. We passed millions of dollars for AC in this past budget. But I wasn't about to sit around and twiddle my thumbs until the next session to do something, so I thought, when I got a phone call from a mother who asked if I could just get one fan for my kid in the classroom, it would make all the difference in the world. So my staff and I talked, and we started the Cool Schools Forever campaign, which was just to get people or businesses to donate fans to schools, which is completely legal. It's asking people to donate to the government, basically, to the schools. it got a lot of really positive attention. And then, of course, we got a call from the Ethics Commission. And they started to ask some questions about, well, they wanted to make sure there's no nonprofit involved, because there are ethical issues when you start to use state government offices or resources for private nonprofits. And I assured them there's no nonprofit, and there's not. We weren't accepting any money, even though people came to us with thousands of dollars. I said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to touch money. There's other nonprofits you can go to. I should say there are nonprofits you can go to.
Or the stores themselves, which we're trying to help.
Yeah, you know, go. And so we encourage them to buy fans. I'll pick them up. I picked up. We've donated 163 so far. So they had some initial questions. And a little bit of make sure everything's above board is fine. But it seemed to me the overwhelming repetitiveness of the questions, it was kind of like an intimidation attack, trying to just find any kind of dirt on somebody who's just trying to do good things for the community. And it was really upsetting. I'm an ethics professor. You know, that's my day job. I teach philosophy and ethics. I've published in this area. And there comes a point where you kind of have to stand up and say enough's enough. And I think I've got the bona fides in my professional life to stand up and challenge this. I'm not afraid to stand up for what's right, stand up to a bully, even if they have an ethics hat on. Ethics are extremely important. I've introduced legislation to help boost ethics in government.
So why do you think you were targeted, if you think indeed you were targeted?
I don't think it's just me. I mean, you've got the commission recently, in my mind, attacking students, attacking teachers, attacking Youth Day. And now, you know, just it seems a pattern of using ethics as a cudgel to go after people lately that are involved with kids in schools, when there's so many things, Bethann, in our government that really need to be looked at with a very close microscope to make sure that we aren't having fraud, waste, and abuse in government.
So why do you think that the attention of the Ethics Commission has been so drawn to some of those areas you just mentioned?
Why they have or have not?
Have. The ones that are taking their attention, like looking at issues of you know, Youth Day and the issues with putting fans in classrooms?
That's a great question. I'd like to know the answer myself. I mean,
did you ask them, why are you asking these questions? Aside from the fact that a nonprofit is, you know, clearly not involved with it.
I did, and they assured me that this, you know, you're not in trouble. There's not an investigation. And then they just asked these questions repeatedly, three different ways, the same question about, is there a nonprofit or is there money involved? And I don't know how many times I can make it clear that no, it's just encouraging businesses or moms and dads or neighbors to, you know, get a fan and drop it off at your local school.
But your point that all of this seems to be rather tainted, as the originator of all of this through Les Condo's, you know, admission was the Attorney General, which doesn't seem to be the case from what you called.
Yeah,
so, I mean, how do you process this whole thing?
I'm still trying to process it. And Doug Chin, again, has clearly stated that it's not from him. There's no investigation. They're not concerned about it. I guess somebody from the office had called, but that doesn't even mean necessarily it's the AG's office doing it.
Right. So what do you take from this as you look forward and to how the commission is operating and what happens from this point on?
I'm glad you asked that. The important thing is I'm not going to be intimidated. I'm not going to, and I don't think other legislators or community leaders or people in government should have this chilling effect that if you do something good, watch out, the Ethics Commission will be at your door looking over your shoulders trying to find dirt. The moral problem with this is that it can prevent people in a position to help, it can affect them to not want to help if they're afraid that the Ethics Commission is going to come knocking. But I'm happy to stand up and fight for the good fight, even on this issue, because like I said, I've got a PhD in philosophy. I know
right,
ethics,
isn't
and I'm
there
not
a place,
afraid to
though,
stand up and say what's right and what's wrong.
Right, but isn't there a place for the Ethics Commission to be able to nose around if they think something is perhaps amiss?
Well, and that's where the letter comes in that the House staff attorney had written, and there's a legal question because there are investigative powers, as there should be for an ethics commission, once there's a real complaint, somebody swears testimony, or once three commissioners vote and say, yes, let's look into this. And as far as anybody can tell, none of that's been done. And so going off on witch hunts to try to find anything to start an investigation is not within the purview of a body like this. Rather, there are rules by which a rules committee has to operate, and they can't just make up the rules as they go along, and they sure as heck can't just ignore rules when they find them inconvenient to go off and try to intimidate people or really abuse the power in trying to find dirt on something where there's no dirt.
Does this put an end to it for you?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we're waiting for the letter back from the Ethics Commission. I mean, there's two separate issues. Is there an ethical issue with the Cool Schools Forever program? Absolutely not. But is there a larger issue where I think there's bad moral consequences of how the Ethics Commission is conducting itself? That's a separate issue. And, you know, we'll see where that goes.
Thanks for coming in and talking to us this morning.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Matt Lopresti represents several EVA communities in District 41.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we went looking for the name of an Oahu community that has continued to thrive more than a decade after the shutdown of its sugar mill. In the early years of the 20th century, the mill was one of the most productive in the state. It was owned by Castle & Cook, which built surface water collection systems around the town that gave the local plantation the largest water storage capacity in Hawaii. The result was a sharp increase in production from 5,000 to 20,000 tons annually. The mill also generated its own electricity, enough to sell small amounts to nearby communities. The sugar mills now host to a variety of local businesses that keep some of the traditions of plantation days alive in Waialua, the Oahu North Shore community we're thinking about this morning. And Beth Ann, we have a winner, yeah?
We do have a winner. Devin Martin called us from Pearl City, and we'll be receiving the T-shirt.
All right, at 844, that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from REC Solar, a commercial contractor that designs, installs, finances, and maintains commercial solar PV systems throughout the state. More at recsolar.com.
Aloha, I'm Chief Warrant Officer Michael J. Smith from the Marine Forces Pacific Band. You're tuned to HBR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
Time for Stargazer, our weekly look at what's happening in the enormous universe around our extremely small planet. As usual, we connect with Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week's Stargazers, our beautiful ringed giant Saturn continues to put on a dazzling celestial display until it sets at around about 9:44 p.m. Now, our moon will be approaching the full moon phase this week, making stargazing here in the islands a little challenging due to the intense light from the sun that is reflected by its surface.
No amount of looking with the naked eye would discover the binary star system that they've been looking at on the Mauna Kea summit.
That's right. This week, it's a bizarre discovery from the Canada-France-Hawaii Telescope, or the CFHT as it's known on the mountain. A young PhD student using the telescope has discovered two massive stars in the Epsilon Lupi star system. These two stars are locked together in a gravitational and magnetic embrace. It's a type of star system we call a binary star.
And that means those are two suns, basically?
Two massive suns orbiting very close together. In fact, most star systems in the galaxy are composed of binary star systems, and sometimes even triple or quadruple star systems.
Sort of like in Star Wars, in the very first one, when
That's right.
Luke is out in the desert with that cool gizmo he used to drive around in, and they've got multiple suns.
Yeah, and we've actually actually found a star system that looks pretty much like Tatooine from Star Wars.
Tell us more about the discoveries that they made.
Well, at first glance, they appear to be normal binary stars. As you said, just two stars orbiting one another. But what astronomers didn't expect to find were that these stars have interacting magnetic fields.
And the magnetic field originates how?
Well, weirdly, only around 2% of binary stars have magnetic fields, so this is quite unusual.
Is there anything weird going on with the magnetic field?
There is indeed, actually. This magnetic embrace of the two stars is actually causing them to be locked in a death spiral. So what's happening is the magnetic field is slowing down the orbits of the stars, and in the long term, they will eventually spiral into one another.
And that's going to be a big fireworks show that we can expect in how many millions of years? Or
it's going to be a long time. Okay. I certainly won't be around to see it.
Well, you never know, Christopher. Christopher Phillips, Mauna Kea Astronomy Outreach Committee, thank you very much for the report.
You're welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
There are some losses that time can never completely heal, but even in the aftermath of terrible loss, we have an obligation to keep going. Denise Karabinas is a Honolulu-based artist and printmaker who lost her infant son 2 years ago and explores that sense of loss in a new exhibition called Nurturing Absence. She's with us this morning. Good morning, Denise.
Hi, Chris. Thanks.
What was the feeling that you most wanted to impart through this show?
I think initially when I was doing the work, I wasn't exactly sure what the feeling I wanted to impart is, but the work itself reveals to me the sense of helplessness that I felt in the face of my son's illness. And slowly as I've actually developed the series of work, I can see that I'm recovering and that I'm slowly healing through the process. And so there's sort of a sense of hope in the work now. So if you can see the whole series from beginning to end to where I am today, there's a transition from very severe pain, desperate kind of longing, and then the work evolves. And now I am in a stage where I'm really taking good care of myself, and I'm having a sense of hopefulness for the future.
So there's some light emerging in all of this.
Yeah, definitely. I see that in the work especially. Sometimes it's a little bit hard to recognize that in my own day-to-day life, but the work itself actually reveals it.
Well, you know, it's interesting because some works of art start with a very clear intention. I'm going to make something that says this. And some come about as they are being created, which sounds like the latter is what happened with you.
Yeah, I think of my print work and my drawings as almost like a journal. So in the creation of the drawing and then committing that drawing to the plate through the printmaking process, I'm actually telling myself my own story. Mm-hmm. And so my own story doesn't always reveal itself until it's actually out in the world as an image. And so I think of it as a journal.
It sounds as if you're, in a way, your hand is being guided by something other than conscious intellectual decisions.
Yeah, it's definitely, for me, it's always the things that are going on behind the screen. Mm-hmm. So in my day-to-day life, I have to function. I, you know, go to work and I teach and I do the things that I do in the day-to-day life. There aren't a lot of opportunities in your daily life to express grief, to express sadness, longing. But those things are constantly happening behind the screen. So in the back of my mind, I'm constantly thinking about my son, thinking about my experiences. And I'm able to actually share those experiences in what I think of as a productive way through my artwork. And I can share and tell my stories in very beautiful and kind of appropriate ways that other people can absorb through the visual artwork.
Before there can be art, Denise, there has to be craft, right? In especially in something like printmaking, where there's a great deal of technique, and you have to be really immersed in the actual process of making that image.
Right. So as a printmaker, there's a lot of process that happens before the artwork is created. There's the drawing process that happens first. Then you commit that drawing to a copper plate. So we have a large sheet of copper, and we protect it with a protective surface and then scratch our image, our drawing, onto the surface and then etch it in ferric chloride to actually commit the image to the copper plate. So there's a lot of things that happen in the process of creating the image. And in my case, often I'm cutting those prints up and then reformatting them into collage and into different formats. And so there's a lot of steps along the way, and the ideas that I have are often evolving and changing as the print develops.
But you can't change what's on that drawing. That's a fairly early commitment in the process, right?
Yes, the drawing on the plate is very committed because you're actually etching it into the copper.
Yeah.
So that drawing on the plate is solid and it's there. And you can print hundreds of them. You don't just get one. So I make one drawing, but then I could print 200 prints from the same plate very easily. But then I take those prints and I cut them up and reformat them into all different kinds of configurations. I can print it in different colors, and I can really tell that story in an unlimited number of ways through the image-making process.
And yet, you know, that early, I'm snagging on the idea of that early commitment because, you know, if you're drawing charcoal, you can erase, and sometimes there's a lot of revisions that happen when the image is almost complete, but you don't have that luxury, do you? You can't give in to second thoughts about the overall image.
In some ways, no, but there's really a lot of opportunities for the image to evolve. So although it is committed to that copper plate and that kind of comes out of the printmaking press in one format, after that, it's unlimited. Even in the printing process, you can print it in any number of different colors. You can add different things to the plate to change the meaning. So that
can really make a change in the overall image.
Definitely. And I actually transform a lot of my prints into sculptural works, which is kind of unusual for a printer. I like to work in dimensional forms. And so a lot of times I'm actually wrapping those prints around a form and making it take a completely different shape.
Which is really an expansion of the original of the printmaker's art into 3D.
Yes, yeah. And it's a very rich terrain for me in terms of meaning. So for an example I could give you, I'm doing this series of prints right now where I'm screen printing onto paper, and then I screen print tiers onto paper, and then I transform those papers into pillows. And one of the titles of one of those works is, I'm going to sleep on it. And so an image on a piece of paper of tiers is one thing, but an image of tiers on a pillow has a very different meaning.
It's also the whole notion of taking your tears and making them mean something.
Correct, yeah. So for me, it's a really rich medium. I find printmaking that it's limitless in terms of the ways that you can transform meaning. And in my own life, I'm trying to transform meaning. So from having my son pass away, I feel like I need to make something productive happen from that. It's such a tragic loss. And, you know, he was with us for just such a short amount of time. And now I want to be able to do something and bring that into other people's lives. And a lot of parents don't feel comfortable talking about the loss of their children. And so sometimes when I open up that conversation, it allows them to feel free to share their story.
Which is a powerful thing to do. Thank you so much, Denise.
All right, thank you.
Denise Karabinas is a Honolulu-based artist and printmaker whose new show, Nurturing Absence, opens with a reception Wednesday, September 23rd, day after tomorrow, at 5 o'clock at Brew Bar's Merchant Street location in Honolulu. The event is open to the public and free of charge. You can learn more about her and her work on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Kahilu Theater, presenting Fandango, a new quartet whose repertoire includes Latin, Balkan, and classical pieces. 7 p.m. this Friday, kahilutheater.org.
To experience a more intimate, relaxed, and timeless side of Rome, you've got to experience the cobbled streets and piazzas of the Eternal City by night.
I've discovered I've become very attached to the way the city is lit.
Join us for A Guide to Rome After Dark and the lesser-known edges of New York City beyond the Do Not Enter signs. It's all on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tuesday at 4 p.m. following Fresh Air.
Chris, I was...
Go ahead, please.
I was watching all of us as you were talking to Denise a moment ago, and no one was moving while she was talking about her process, and more than just the process, the meaning behind it with the loss of her son and trying to make that come into something that would be a lesson or something positive that she could take forward in her life.
Well, it has to, and it has to yield forth lessons, not just for her, but for anyone who experiences her work, that, you know, those of us left behind after a tragedy have a kind of an obligation to go on, that we can't destroy ourselves because of something adverse that has happened like that. So I thought it was a really powerful testimony to the power of craft, immersing yourself in your craft, making art to get in touch with your own emotions and maybe even help other people.
And taking tears on a piece of paper and turning them to real tears on a pillow, which there have been many, many, I'm sure, in her situation.
Yeah, a powerful story.
It was. And we will hopefully have more for you as we go into tomorrow. Coming up, we've got Beth Giesting, the state's healthcare initiative director, looking at new initiatives, and Neil Conan will join us from the farm.
And the Honolulu Fire Department creates an art exhibit with the goal of promoting public safety. We like to hear from you. You can call our talk back line and leave us your comments anytime you like. Our number is 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet us at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of the show, you can just look on our archive. It's on HPR2.org. You can find lots of links and information about guests there, too.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation. See you then.